I want to welcome all of you here to this really jam-packed session on why invest in America's children. I'm Joan Harris, and I'm chairman of the Irving Harris Foundation. I have two things I want to say. First, please, everybody, turn off your cell phones. That's the unimportant part of it. And the next part is to William Bell. I want to thank the Casey Foundation so much for funding this track in America's Children. We couldn't have put together such a wonderful track without the help of the Casey Family Programs, and so thank you very, very much. For more than 30 years, the Harris Foundation, under the leadership of the late Irving Harris, was the pioneer in recognizing the necessity of increasing our knowledge and understanding of infants and creating programs to improve the outcomes for infants at risk. Today, there is an amazing group of funders, and you're looking at them, who are highly focused on children age 0 to 5. People assembled here are the real thinkers in the funding community in the field of early childhood. They are, in fact, so renowned that in the 1 hour allocated to us, I was tempted to spend the whole time on introducing them. But I will control myself and give a short introduction for each of the people here. In the large brochures that you've gotten, there are biographical notes on each of the participants. The moderator of the panel is Dan Peterson, who is sitting right there. Dan is president of the Buffett Early Childhood Fund and founder of Birth to Five Policy Alliance. He'll be moderating the program. And starting from over there, at my far right, I want to start with introducing George Kaiser. He has dedicated his acute business skills and entrepreneurship in developing high-quality early childhood education programs for children at risk, primarily in the state of Oklahoma. Next to him is Susie Buffett. Susie is chairman of the Sherwood Foundation and the Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, where the areas of interest include early childhood education for low-income families. Then comes William Bell, who is president and CEO of the Casey Family Programs. It's a foundation that's working to improve the lot of children in foster care and to improve conditions so much that eventually there will be no need for foster care. And right here nearest to us is William Gates Sr. He's co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In 2005, the foundation launched a $90 million investment in a new learning strategy for children from birth to 5. He is also co-chair of the Thrive by Thrive Washington organization. I know we're going to have a fabulous hour, and I'm going to get out of the way.
Thank you, Joan. This afternoon, we're going to talk about investing in America's children, particularly early childhood. A discussion that I think really boils down to two words, values and value. We'll hear why each of these four foundations, and more importantly, why each of these panelists as individual champions have come to believe that investments in the earliest years are wise and are necessary. Three of the foundations on stage have recently joined forces to support a new organization called the Birth to Five Policy Alliance. And for that, I thank them, as does Alliance Chairman Dr. Joan Lombardi, who's here today. You can visit the website at www.birthtofivepolicy.org, and that's the end of that commercial. Suffice it to say, there's so much to do if we are to really close the gap between, in Dr. Jack Shonkoff's famous phrase, what we know from the science of early childhood and what we do in service delivery. So, panelists, a straightforward question to start. Why are you investing in early childhood, George Kaiser?
Thanks, Dan. I have to say to start, though, that I'm honored to be introduced by Joan Harris. She and her husband uncovered this big idea. We're pathfinders in understanding early childhood education more than 30 years ago, and all of us on the panel are latecomers, but I'm even worse as a latecomer, I guess, because I think everyone else on this panel has been laboring in these gardens for longer than I have. So I'm going to comment first as the newbie on the platform, I guess. I came to early childhood education largely from the perspective of a social entrepreneur, and you probably know what that term means. It's commonly used today. It means, to me at least, that you analyze a problem in the same fashion that you perhaps would analyze a business problem. You identify what the greatest priorities are, what the greatest needs are, you identify solutions, and then you implement them and you measure the results. So I try to do it dispassionately. Obviously, in the field of charity and philanthropy, you can't do anything perfectly dispassionately. But what I noticed was that after 40 years of a war on poverty, more than 40 years, after this greatest nation in the history of the world, at least in terms of physical wealth, was unable to eliminate the cycle of poverty. Kids born into poverty generally grew up, and their children were born in roughly the same condition in which they were born. And this violates the American social contract, seems to me. What we stood for, what differentiated us from the Europeans, the old Europe, I guess is the new phrase, is that we did have social mobility, that people did leave the condition into which they were born and yield some success in life, however measured. And it wasn't happening here. So that was the problem I identified, and I got frustrated by it. I had a lot of guilt about it because I was born in this rich nation. I was born in relatively good circumstances. I felt that I didn't have a right to win what Susie's father calls the ovarian lottery. I was fortunate. And the other 99% of the people in the world who didn't win the ovarian lottery, whether in the U.S. or elsewhere, were disadvantaged. So I came across upon it because it seemed inequitable and because it seemed to be a solvable problem with the resources we had, and it violated what I saw as the American social contract. As I looked into it, though, some years ago, I discovered that there were some research answers that suggested why we hadn't been able to solve the problem and how we could, and there were some practical applications. Jack Shonkoff has talked at other sessions here about some of the research answers we discovered. We discovered that the connections among brain cells, the neurons, were essentially undeveloped at birth, and I think that's probably because, as I recall it, that place before birth was warm and wet and dark and not much going on, so there was not a lot of sensory stimulation to stimulate the brain cells or the connections among brain cells. Once you emerge, there's an explosion of sensory stimulation, and whether it's productive or non-productive is the critical element. And maybe, just maybe, that dirty little secret we have in the back of our brains that says that rich, smart parents have rich, smart kids because of genetics is wrong. In fact, maybe it's because rich, smart parents tend to put mobiles over the cribs, tend to play Mozart in the womb, tend to read to their kids, talk to them, have the give and take that Jack calls serve in return, and that the stressed, lower-income parent is not able to do that, doesn't have the time to do that, doesn't have the temperament after a day of work to do that. So that was the theoretical construct, and that was a wonderful answer because it suggested that, yes, maybe all people are, in fact, created equal and have an equal opportunity. Then I looked around for practical applications, found the Abecedarian program, which many of you, I'm sure, have looked into in North Carolina in the 70s, and even earlier, the Perry School Preschool Project in Ypsilanti, Michigan in the early 60s, both of which studied the kids in a valid control group and study group for 30 or so years later and discovered dramatic differences if that sensory stimulation were provided. So I kind of committed myself to the moral imperative that no child was responsible for the circumstances of his or her birth, that there was an economic way to equal opportunity at the time of birth, and thereafter, and that there is a payoff economically. And so I became committed to it and remain committed to it.
Thank you, George. Susie Buffett, why are you investing in early childhood?
Well, first of all, I was sort of, I think, unconsciously or subconsciously brainwashed as a child with two parents who, my mother was very active in social justice issues and actually started, along with a few other people, Head Start in Omaha in our living room. So that was sort of going on all along as I was a child. And my father, as George said, that all people are created equal, used to say at the dinner table until about 15 minutes after they're born. And so I grew up in this world of those things going on all the time. And we, my brothers and I all, I think, were fortunate to have the parents we had to raise us that way. So when my parents set up the foundations in 2000, I knew I wanted to do something for public education. I went to our superintendent in Omaha. And for those of you who have not been to Omaha, and I'm guessing that's most of you, you're missing something. The Omaha Public Schools, there are almost a million people in Omaha. And the Omaha Public Schools has 47,000 students with 67 languages in it. Two are unwritten, actually. So we have a superintendent and a majority of free and reduced lunch kids in the school district. So we have a superintendent who's very enlightened, very smart. We went to him and said, what can we do for public education? In my brain, it was K through 12. I take no credit for the fact that I'm in early childhood. It's other people that explained how important this was to me. And he said, we need the kids to come to kindergarten ready. These kids are not stupid. They just don't have opportunities like other kids. And if they came into kindergarten prepared, we can do our job. So we went back to the drawing board and thought it made huge sense. It's a total no-brainer when you start thinking about it, and that's how we got into it.
I'm sure you'll not be surprised that I've never heard that story before.
He was there.
William Bell, can you talk to us about why you're making your investments?
Well, prior to coming to Casey Family Programs, I ran New York City's Child Welfare Agency, and what I've gone through over the last almost 25 years in dealing with child welfare in America has really resulted in this belief that the future of America, the hope for the future of America, rests in its children, but in all of its children. And every night in America, about 500,000 children go to sleep in somebody else's bed. And for those children coming out of lives of trauma, the challenges that they face just in getting through a day are greater than anything we can imagine. And then you take that child who is laden with the trauma of being separated from their families and place them in an educational environment and expect them to learn at the same pace as every other child in that environment. It creates huge challenges for the individual children. And so coming to Casey Family Programs, I've found an opportunity to really begin to push how we think about what we need to do for these children. And how do we make sure that they are not laden with the actions of their parents or other caregivers for the rest of their lives. What we found in terms of looking at education for children coming out of foster care is that if you talk to children who are aging out of foster care, 70% of them will tell you that they want to go to college. About 25 to 30% of them actually go to college, and only about 3% actually get a four-year college degree. And so from our perspective, in order to change that, you've got to start early. And we can't wait until children are in their teens or aging out of foster care to decide to get them ready for higher education. So from our perspective, early childhood education is a key not only for children in the general population, but specifically for children in foster care.
Thank you. And Bill Gates, Sr.
A couple of things. First, I was listening to the really remarkable things that people who are engaged in the science of understanding brain operations and what is happening inside the head of the very youngest of children, and learning what enormous potential there is during those first 5 years when we pay very little attention to them in terms of education. It's all pretty much by chance. And it began to be obvious that the concerns that the foundation where I work was working on for K-12 education were to some extent a function of young kids entering kindergarten unprepared. And in the course of that, I heard a story, which I told here yesterday, but I think there's no law against redundancy. I know there's no law against redundancy. You just think about this five-year-old girl who went off to kindergarten for her first day and sat down between two other children her same age, one of which was already reading to some extent, and the other which knew his numbers and how to tell time, neither of which were things she had the slightest notion about. She comes home from that kindergarten experience that her mother asks her, well, how was school? And her response is, Mother, I hate school. That's a pretty tough way to start a 12-year operation. And it's easy, it seems to me, to reason from that why so many kids never really do get started getting an education and why so many, by the time they get to high school, have turned off from education completely. It's clear to me what everyone is saying, that a great part of solving the problem of our effective education of our young people is working in the earliest years of their lives.
Well, I think that gives us a sense of the why behind the values in each of your investments, but it would be good, I think, for all of us to hear more specifically a description of the investments you're each making now and how you each came to adopt your particular focus and approach within early childhood. And this time, let's start with Susie.
Okay, well, after we visited our superintendent, he said we'd prefer you went 0 to 5 instead of K through 12. We had no idea what to do at that point. And so we started looking around for who was doing the best and smartest things in the country, and we came upon the Answer Prevention Fund in Chicago, which Irving Harris started, and Harriet Meyer runs, and we went to see them. They had just at that point started, I don't think it was quite open, the Educare Center, but it was there. And it was this, what we thought, brilliant idea, low ratios, social workers on staff, certified teachers, all these things that made huge sense. And we spent a lot of time learning about what they had been doing, and we decided to build one in Omaha. And honestly, at that point, we really thought we would just build one in Omaha. And people started hearing about it and showing up from all over. It was really very exciting. And we're actually now building a second one in Omaha, and that's how we got going. It sort of mushroomed into something that nobody expected to happen, but it's very, very exciting. And I really think it can change the whole, you know, if we get these kids ready and they go into kindergarten prepared, and it does have to start at birth, we can change the country. I believe that.
Do you want to field that? They want to know what Educare is and what the point is.
The point of Educare is to take children from birth to five and totally prepare them in every way. It's not just, you know, knowing their what they need to know academically to get into kindergarten and succeed, but it's also all the social and emotional development that goes along with it, which is enormously important. It's enormously important. These kids come out of terrible situations, and they need to learn how to do all, I mean, you know, we all did all this stuff with our kids. We rocked them, and we talked to them, and we looked at them, and we taught them how to use a spoon, and we did all this stuff that doesn't happen, and taught them to share, and taught them how to sit quietly in the classroom, all the things that don't happen in every household. And so this is and we can get into a lot more detail specifically about Educare. I just don't want to take up too much time, but it's basically, and Harriet, scream something out if I'm wrong about this, but it's low ratios, it's social workers on staff to support the families, it's certified teachers, and it's a year-round incredible program that takes these kids, and then I'm going to get into too much stuff and I'll stop, but the numbers that we're starting to see already, even from kids who haven't been through the full 5 years, are just astounding. It will work.
Yeah, I would just add in that elaboration that when we took a sort of national look at who had built the best mousetrap, we were impressed not just by the program model itself, but by the ability of the Ounce Prevention Fund, which Irving Harris founded, to connect highest quality service delivery with new policy leverage, that you don't just deliver service, you also go to work in your legislature to make more high-quality service available. And it's that marriage between practice and policy that has a lot of potential to change how we do business in America. William Bell.
We started down our action path by asking ourselves a question in 2005. And that question was, what if nothing changed in the way we were dealing with foster children in America between 2005 and the year 2020? And the answer to that question was more than just concerning, but motivating to actually do something differently. The answer to that question was that if we do nothing differently than the way we've treated children in foster care from 2005 to the year 2020, 14 million more children will become victims of child abuse and neglect in America. 9 million more children will experience the foster care system in America. 300,000 of those children will age out of foster care into adulthood, unprepared to exist in adulthood. And about 75,000 of them will experience homelessness. And that number that I quoted earlier, about only 3% of that 300,000 expecting to get a four-year college degree. And so our response was, we have to do something and do something differently, but not just Casey Family Programs doing something, but those who are responsible for the needs of foster children around the country have to do something differently. And so what we've started is something we call a 2020 campaign, which has as its core components to influence a 50% reduction in the size of the foster care system by the year 2020. Of those 500,000 children, over 75% of them are in just 20 states out of the country. And so what we've designed is a strategic consulting service that we will offer free of charge to every child welfare jurisdiction in the country to help them improve the quality of what they're doing with children in foster care. And we're primarily focused in three areas: education, employment, and mental health. And on the education side, we are essentially using models that have been effective in working with children in New York, the models that are working in the state of Washington, in the state of California, and we're essentially saying you don't have to reinvent the wheel. We will support your efforts and we will bring the best practices from around the country to your state so that you can do what's right by the children in your care and custody.
Bill Gates?
Well, our approach to it was that in almost all of these social reform things, that at the bottom it was a public problem, and at the bottom the resources to have a program which was working and which was widespread and all-inclusive was going to require action by the government. But that models needed to be created and ideas about the best way to do it needed to be inculcated in whatever the state was doing. So in our case, the state did very promptly start a Department of Early Learning separate from the Superintendent of Public Education and set up governmental activities to make early learning happen in a couple of model places in the state. Our concern it has to do with some particulars. The one thing that seemed to us important to have be a central ingredient of the program is the fact that real efficacy here is a function of changing the way inadequate parents deal with their children. And we're optimistic that that is an avenue which can be pursued successfully, that there are a whole variety of means to get at folks who have a child, who are frustrated by the circumstances of their life and therefore not doing justice to the relationship with that child. And actually, the means to get there and create this sense of attachment between parent and child are very, very well known, very well understood. So we think that that that's an ingredient of the early learning activity which needs to be emphasized, and we're anxious that that be part of whatever program we're helping to finance. The other reality is that we're talking about a very, very significant change in public education. This is an add-on to public education of a very serious kind, because at its bottom, it's child care. It's kids being put in a child care center so mom can go to work. And child care centers aren't contributing anything to this problem, on the contrary. So increasing the quality of child care, having standards for them, that whole thing, and critically, providing subsidies to people to have their children in this improved child care system, and that will be bloody expensive before we get it in place and get everybody involved. And finally, it's been our observation that in a lot of the social reforms that occur, and again, focusing at the poor end of our society, is that we don't successfully recruit the kids who should be in the program. That we put a poster up on the bulletin board at the high school, or we rely on word of mouth, or things of that kind. And there are, I think, a significant percentage of the persons who need the work of this reform who are left out of it. And it's our judgment and our view that as this goes forward, one of the elements of it needs to be that people in those child care centers and people concerned about this in particular communities find out where that mother and child are and go knock on the door. And that is bloody expensive too. But it seems to us that the parental thing, the subsidized daycare, and this effective recruitment are things that need to be a part of the program.
And George Kaiser, to wrap up.
After I finished passing through my Jeremy Bentham phase, trying to identify what could be done for the greatest good for the greatest number, and I'd identified that prenatal and very early intervention in the cycle of poverty, especially early childhood education, was key. I trod down the same path, I think, that Susie did toward the path of salvation to the Ounce of Prevention Fund in Chicago, and discovered EduCare as well somewhat later. Thought it was the best model that implemented what I had learned about Abbasidarian and Perry and others, and decided that we should adopt it in Tulsa as well. And as we did do that, and as we built a first school in Tulsa and are also scheduling a second school, we determined that every time we solved one little piece of the problem, there were several more that built upon it. And so the next thing, the obvious question people can ask us is, well, that's wonderful. You have a flagship demonstration project, and you're helping 200 kids. How many of them need it? Well, in Tulsa, birth to three alone is 10,000 kids below 185% of the poverty level. So what did we do? We said we'll sponsor birth to three slots because the federal government sponsors, I think, 62,000 nationally. They sponsor 104 in Tulsa. It's about 0.2% of the need, or 1% of the need in Tulsa, I guess. So we're sponsoring additional early Head Start slots to parallel the federal government slots. We discovered that health care was critical, and Jack's still educating me on that subject about how important health care is in the very early point of life development, both social, emotional, and cognitive, of a child. So we are putting healthcare clinics in each of the 25 low-income elementary schools, and those healthcare clinics feed into a master clinic, so that the kids and their siblings and the parents will get decent healthcare. We're wrestling with the issue of prenatal and perinatal care, and we don't have a good answer yet. We have lots of ideas and proposals. But clearly, addressing that in a scalable fashion is critical. Training is important. The first thing I learned when we started agreeing to sponsor additional slots from the person who was running the schools was, we don't have enough teachers prepared to do it. We don't have enough pay for the teachers who do it. We don't have enough respect and prestige in the trade. So we have formed a associate bachelor and master's degree program in early childhood education, focusing on infants and toddlers, one of maybe two or three in the country. And our goal is to turn out far more graduates of this program than we can use ourselves, although we will try to corral them into some nearby geography. We have to train the teachers we already have, both the ones who go through this new program and the ones who are pre-existing. So we've collaborated with Ron Lally and the West Ed group to come in every summer and train our teachers and teachers from both Oklahoma and a little bit around the country in how to properly educate young infants and toddlers. We work in the legislative realm. My foundation hired a couple of lobbyists, and we have started displaying evidence to red state America. We have a half Republican House, and we have one that's actually split exactly down the middle, 50-50, and one that is Republican-led. And the message is somewhat different, but we're finding a very receptive audience to the message that says that all of these, that this is not a nanny state solution, which is something you may have heard in other places. We are not, the police power of the state is not coming into the homes and grabbing kids out of the cradle, taking them away from their mothers and pretending that they can inculcate the proper culture into them better than their family can. But Ozzie and Harriet died a while back, and Harriet said earlier this morning in Illinois, 90% of kids, low-income kids, are currently in daycare. The number is 88% in Oklahoma. So the first message you bring to a red state legislator, I think, is these kids are already in daycare. All we're trying to do is improve the quality of the care that they're receiving, provide a significant educational and social-emotional component so that you and your society and your family can be satisfied that you're doing what you charitably need to do for people in need, and you feel you can be safe because you can predict that these people have a greater chance of ending up in the correctional system if you do not. And that's a message that does tend to resonate too much on the legislative front, I guess. But results measurement's a very difficult one, and we're following the lead of the Bounce Network, and we're participating and to make very sure that we understand every element of the program and what its impact is and which are the more important. And that's a question that people have tried to answer for a number of years and done a reasonably good job at it, but it's a question that needs to be repeatedly tested. And then we figured out very early that we can't just have early childhood education, whether it's birth to three or birth to five, without the follow-through, because one of the terrible statistics of American life is that we have a deterioration in the academic abilities of our kids beyond, especially in the middle school years, unlike almost any other country in the world. So we've looked around for other programs there. We haven't found the promised land yet. We very much like the KIPP school project for 5th to 8th grade. We're investing in that and in other programs. And then the last thing is we want to make the EduCare school a community school. We want to adopt the half-square-mile neighborhood around it. If the half-square-mile neighborhood most needs immigration assistance, then we'll work with that. If it's health care, if it's access to social services, if it's drug programs, whatever it may be. And we're at the very early stages of wrestling with that. But that's more than my 3 minutes of fame here.
Thank you, George. Just to make clear to those who might not have heard of it, the Bounce Network, which George referenced, is a network of EduCare centers. There are now six or seven up and running. The goal within 2 years is to have 12 to 15 of these highest quality centers in 10 to 12 states. And the intriguing part of these centers is that, once again, they're not just about service delivery. They're about policy change. So they each become a sort of showroom for lawmakers to see what quality looks like in the earliest years of life. And one of the most powerful parts of them are that each center has an anchor funder. In Tulsa, it's George Kaiser. In Omaha, it's Susie. In Seattle, it's the Gates Foundation. And this network becomes then not just a network of highest quality centers, it becomes a network of like-minded philanthropists who are basically working at the same coalface with the same intent. I know we want to leave time for questions, but before we move to that, I think it would be good, since all four names on the podium are famous business names, Casey in Seattle. I think we all know what the Gates name does, and I'm proudly carrying my Microsoft computer. The question is...
some of us up here have famous parents.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
The point is, each of your foundations rests on a strong business name. So, I think it would be interesting to hear you each speak about what kind of return on your philanthropic investments you're seeing now, and what kind of returns you expect over the long haul. And we'll start that with William.
Nobel laureate James Heckman and some other economic experts have concluded that for every dollar invested in high-quality early childhood, there's about a $4 to $17 return on that investment. From our perspective, in terms of what we're doing in Casey Family Programs with our 2020 effort, our investment, the return on our investment has to be in building stronger communities where vulnerable children reside. I don't think that we in America are short on knowledge about how to raise strong and healthy children. I do think that we are short on how do we apply that knowledge when we're dealing with the most vulnerable children in our communities and their families. And I think that what we've got to do and what we're seeking to do is to begin to work with children in the context of their families and to see their families in the context of the communities in which they live and to then see those communities in the context of being a stronger family support network. Because government can't do this alone. And the philanthropic community, along with government, can't do this alone. We've got to mobilize stronger communities where the children reside so that the kind of support that is necessary for vulnerable families exists right next door, and that we're not relying solely on government to intervene and to change the future for vulnerable children. In New York City, one of the most challenging things for me was always when something went wrong with a child, there were tons of neighbors who stood up to say, I knew this was happening. And so the return on our investment is that someday, between now and the year 2020, in our communities, people will not only be saying, I knew this was happening, but I intervened and did something to change it in my community.
The next William in line.
I don't really have anything to add to that, Dan. The studies are, you know, they're very, very sophisticated and very, I think, very thorough, and the return is enormous. And that's part of what motivates us to be enthusiastic about this one.
Great. George?
I'll also try to leave some room for questions. I certainly have also followed the Heckman and Rolnick studies that show an economic return, but you also need to have the moral return that William spoke of. The kids are born into poverty, are not responsible for their own circumstances, and what other style of help to people do we measure by economic return per se? There is a benefit to the person himself or herself, and you have a moral obligation in society to give that person an equal opportunity. So yes, there is an economic return, and yes, we're going to seek out the best answer. And yes, there's at least an apocryphal story that Oregon measures the number of jail cells they'll need 15 years later by the third grade reading level. But I don't think you can rely exclusively on the statistics and the results, because as you know, 46.7% of all statistics are created on the fly.
I don't really have anything to add either. I agree with all of that. I want to make one quick point, because I don't know if people understand this. The EduCare, the whole EduCare project that we're all involved in is a public-private partnership. And I don't know if that was clear, but it's private money that builds these buildings, but it is public money that runs the program. So it's really beautiful.
And one of the beautiful things about that is leverage,
because
the private sector encourages the public sector to work together in new ways. Preschools are done by school system across the country, and states deliver state child care dollars across the country, and the federal government has Head Start and Early Head Start, but in most communities, those public programs operate in silos. And the idea behind EduCare is if you get those three levels of government to work more comprehensively together, you can deliver higher quality services. And so that, I think, is, in Susie's view, I know, the role of the private sector to serve as a catalyst to help the public sector to work better. But it is not Susie's notion that the private sector should be replacing the public sector.
No. The only other thing, since I said I wasn't going to say anything, the other thing, you bring up the economic piece, and it is my father who's the business person, not me. And he has sort of let the three of us go in our own directions, but he has been to EduCare a few times, and he was there a few weeks ago with Governor Culver from Iowa who wanted to see what we were doing. And it's very interesting for me to watch my father walk through there because his brain is all rational business thinking. That's where he comes from, and it's what he thinks about. And he gets very emotional, actually, about what we're doing. And when he left there, and he said this to me a couple of other times, he said, "Suze, you've hit a home run. This stuff matters more than anything else." So he's a smart man.
I think with that, we could move to questions from the floor. There's about 5 minutes left for this lunch session. The plenary start at 1:15. We can go past 1 o'clock if there's an appetite to do so, but we want to leave before the plenaries begin. So who would like to start from the floor?
Yeah, no, I'll ask one. I'm Jim Sire. I work in the child advocacy world for a long time. What you guys are doing is great, and the early child investment stuff is obviously couldn't be more important in terms of what we're trying to do, but I have a question for all of you guys in the context of how you're going to scale this, because the same kind of thing that your dad said, Susie, you know, people all across this country need to believe in this and need to build a constituency behind it. So a real question I'm asking you guys, and not just pure advocacy, George, and hiring lobbyists, but how much are you all thinking about building a mass constituency base for this most important investment in kids, and what are you guys thinking about in that way in terms of philanthropy?
I would say that the key to scaling is in that word that Dan used, which is leverage. That in terms of what we're looking at, particularly on the Casey Family Program side, we don't for one second believe that we have the resources necessary to cover the cost of every child who would experience foster care or child abuse and neglect in this country. What we do understand is that there are government systems that are already in place to do this work, and that part of what we bring to the table from the private perspective is the know-how that we bring to the table and the ability to leverage our dollars with the government dollars and other giving in those communities so that we are building stronger, more stable communities by not deciding that we're going to do it all ourselves, but that we're going to join with like-minded people, both in government and in the private sector, to make this happen community by community around the country.
Let me try and answer as well. Call it bribery and deception. Leverage is bribery in a sense, in that what we have done in part is to go to the legislature with our lobbyists, make the case, and then say for every dollar the legislature puts up, we'll match it, or in the first year actually double match it. And once you get it established, one of the blessings and curses of government is that once it's there, it's in the base budget. We don't have zero-based budgeting. Carter's been long forgotten. So what you need to do is somehow, on a small scale, get it started. Similarly, Oklahoma was the first state in the country to have material involvement in Universal Four, preschool for four-year-olds. And it happened kind of by accident through legislation. But once it's there, it's very difficult to challenge. So I think what you have to do, and that's the bribery part, the deception part may be that you start the program and then the continued support of the program grows and grows, and it's very difficult for the state to abandon it at that point. In healthcare, for example, we're building master healthcare clinics. And yes, the private sector is inducing the master healthcare clinics with financial inducement, but then the ongoing cost of providing the service is going to be overwhelming. So Don't want that quoted from here, but I'd say it's bribery and deception.
It's been, we in Nebraska, we've done some interesting things too. You know, it's too bad that every kid can't be an educator, but the reality is that that can't happen. And so I'd like to sort of have every kid have an educator-ish situation if they can't be an educator.
Right.
And we in Nebraska, we actually had to change our constitution to change the definition of the word education to go down to birth instead of, it stopped at, I think it was at five. And but we got it done. And actually, Nebraska's been pretty good on all of this stuff. And we now have an early childhood endowment that's being set up in Nebraska that will disperse money all over the state for early childhood programs. And even just by building the Educare Center, and now we're building the second one, people have started to get it. It's taken a little while, but they've started to get it. Even raising the private dollars for the first one, it was really hard. People are calling us now saying, when are you guys doing the second one? You know, people are starting to understand this better.
Yeah, and I'd just say Oklahoma and Nebraska are not states famous for flaming liberalism.
Uh-uh.
The reason red states are embracing this state-based policy change is that the arguments are largely driven by science and not by ideology. And Jack Shonkoff here in the audience co-edited a document called Neurons to Neighborhoods for the National Academy of Sciences at the beginning of this century, letting us know everything, collecting everything we know about brain development. And we know so much more about brain development in the 21st century than we knew when Head Start was created. So, more questions. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. First, I want to applaud everything you're doing. I have been involved in early childhood development for about 40 years, and you're making a lot of progress, and I have seen it grow. One of the big issues, I think, is the turnover in caregivers for early childhood development centers and family day homes and what other facilities children may be in. And I think one of the major reasons for that, of course, is that it's not considered a profession, and that the kinds of things you're doing at the university in getting graduate degrees or even degrees in that, it will go a long way. That's one of the issues I think really needs to be looked at, because consistency, needless to say, in the child care provider's service for those children in that care is very important. The second piece, which I know is very difficult, is that, as you say, in some of the kinds of institutions or centers that you all have started is wonderful, but there is this tremendous majority of children out there mm-hmm. who can't access that. And in most state legislatures, it's a matter of children or elders. And that's the fight for the dollars. And I think that's something that we have to look at as who wins. You know, older people vote, children don't. And in many cases, the dollars go there. Not that either should not get it, but it's a very difficult challenge, I think. The one thing that we have seen in some other states, or cities actually, is developing, as you're doing, a state fund is a local fund for children's needs. And that is a hard thing to do, but it's a great thing to do if you can do it with a tax-based, you know, one cent of a luxury tax or some other kind of a tax. That's the best thing that you can do to develop a fund that then ought to be administered by a objective group, not by the city or the state, but a United Way or a commission that's set up to do that.
Thanks for your comment. Question over here?
Yes. Are you able to look into the sources of the poverty that is creating these children? Because these children are children of people who've been born since we had the poverty program, since we've had the war on drugs, since we've had a lot of attention to to these kinds of issues. And I'm concerned that if we don't look at some of the sources of why these children are in poverty, we need a lot more philanthropy to help the numbers that are growing faster than the philanthropists.
Who would like to field that?
Well, I can say that in Omaha we are definitely doing that, and we actually have a program, and I can go into a whole speech about this, but we have a program we're just starting in Omaha where, honestly, the mayor and everybody else in the city is involved in this. We have task forces we're setting up, and it's exactly to do that, and it's to go from birth all the way through college and figure out what we can do to address all of the issues that bring these kids down. And I'm hoping that it works. I really think it will work. I'm hoping that it works and we can make it something replicable that people can do, but it's really important.
Probably been the most frustrating element of my pursuit of this issue is exactly what you said, which is there is no single bullet. I prefer simple solutions in which you can see answers very quickly, and of course there isn't one here. And that's why we've branched out so much into healthcare, into social service programs, and in effect adopting a neighborhood and doing everything in that neighborhood. But it's a frustration, and there's not a great answer for it yet.
Jack.
Pretty clever of us, wasn't it?
implicit and explicit in a lot of what people have said is how the base of support is broadened for this with public-private partnerships. And the country is so hungry for something that everyone can get together on, and this is the lowest hanging fruit, obviously, the early childhood issue. And one thing that I wanted to just put on the table was to say that for the people who plan the Aspen Institute, the Ideas Festival, the faith-based community is another powerful force that that really ought to be at the table. I mean, it's a natural, and maybe at a future session here, we could be bringing together the private sector with philanthropy and the public sector and the faith-based community, and then there'll be nobody left who would be opposed to the kind of things we're talking about. And then we could really do some serious work in this area, because if there's anything that could bring the country together, and the previous question, a comment about how older people vote and kids don't. Well, the baby boomers have kind of taken up more than our fair share of attention in this country. And the big question now comes up is what's going to be the legacy of the baby boom generation other than putting the greatest stress on the budgets of Medicare and Social Security and everything else? And this is a natural, particularly in terms of George Kaiser's comment of bringing us back always to the moral responsibility as well as the economic return. I mean, this could be the legacy for the baby boom generation to do something about not just its own grandchildren, but other people's grandchildren in the service of the future of the country. So it seems to me there's room for more broadening of the base of leadership for this, and it's leadership we're talking about, isn't it? That's the thing we're all hungry for here, is leadership.
Jack, you ended the last session with a provocative comment, so maybe I would do the same in response to your comment about how do you get the faith-based folks on board. And one thing I have done with myself and with others who are members of the very strong faith-based community is go back to the question of, what would Jesus do? After all, I didn't read anything in the Sermon on the Mount or any place else about abortion or homosexuality, but I read a whole bunch about your moral obligation to help the more disadvantaged people. So why isn't that fundamental to the faith-based community, that your pure moral obligation is to help the disadvantaged and not get off on the side issues, which he may have talked about, but I didn't see it.
Well, we're 10 minutes past time. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for your questions. Panelists, thank you for all your great answers.